My name is Joan Hunt. I'm a pastor in Portland. I've been a parish pastor for most of my ministry, but just 8 weeks ago, I began as campus minister at Portland State University. This session today is on the idea of covenant in the Old Testament, the experience of covenant, and is particularly about the covenant that God made with Israel through Moses at Sinai in the Old Testament. We have a lot of words in church that are church words, church vocabulary, that don't necessarily mean a whole lot anywhere else but in the realm of church, or they have a special slant the way we use them in church. It's kind of like softball. I've been watching softball games. My older daughter, the 12-year-old, plays softball, and the younger daughter and I've been sitting through endless games, and I keep trying to explain to my younger daughter. She keeps saying, "Is that a home run? Is that bases loaded?" So I'm trying to get clear to her what home runs and bases loaded and all those backstop and shortstop and all those other things are. We have words like that in church that we don't use in other places. So with your partner, please discuss the three most mystifying church words that you can think of. Some of those church words are mystifying unless or until you've had some experience, and then you say, oh, that's what faith means, or something like that. Covenant is one of those words that we use pretty often, the people of the covenant, the old covenant, the new covenant. Old Testament, New Testament actually means the same thing as old covenant, new covenant. The blood of the new covenant in the Eucharist. It's a word that we kind of toss around. What I want to do today and in all my sessions this week, if you're able to come to any of the other ones, is look at different covenants God made at different times in the Old Testament. See what each one of these covenants adds to the general, very rich idea of covenant. Covenant is a metaphor for our relationship with God and with one another on this planet, in this time, and for future generations. That's a very rich metaphor. It's kind of like a layer cake with a lot of different layers and a lot of different flavors. And each covenant that God made adds a little bit of a different flavor to this wonderful, nourishing idea of covenant. So starting with the covenant that God made with Israel at Sinai, my basic theory or thesis is going to be that God made this covenant with two overlapping or two complementary ideas. The one idea is that God is king and establishes an order for what the relationship between God and people and the people and one another will be. But overlapping with that or complementary with that is the idea that God is kin or relative to these people with whom God has made a relationship, and therefore we're all relatives of one another. And I see both of those ideas at work in the covenant at Sinai. Now, when you think of God as king, what ideas come to mind? If you say God is my king, what are you meaning?
He's in charge.
Kind ruler.
And in charge. Some more ideas associated with the idea of king?
Important.
Mm-hmm. Leader.
Leader and important. And what sorts of kings do you think of when you think of king? Do you think of King Arthur or Queen Elizabeth?
The English kings.
The owner.
But also
owner.
Yeah, and I think the blood lineage.
And blood lineage too, the dynasty. That's an idea that comes from David's kingship in particular. Well, we're going to take a look now at a kind of king who is not pictured in the Bible directly, but who lived at the same time as the people lived who wrote the scriptures. In those days, people lived in city-states very often. In other words, they lived in a little place all together, and they often built a wall around where they lived to protect themselves from outsiders, and then they worked the fields outside of there. It reminds us of the feudal system that we know from medieval Europe. And at the head of each community would be a king and a council of elders or priests or something like that. Well, at the time, there also got to be kings who would conquer other city-states and ask for things from them or expect things from them. Or sometimes even the city-states made agreements with one another as equals. But what we're going to look at today is the kind of overlord who would conquer other city-states and then make treaties with them, saying what he expected in return from those people now that they had been conquered. We have a lot of examples of this kind of international treaty from the Hittite Empire in Turkey. That word is spelled this way. The Hittites were a kind of people or a group of people who lived in Turkey around 1400 to 1200 BCE. BCE might not be familiar to all of you. We used to say, and maybe many of us still do, BC and AD. BC meant before Christ, AD meant Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord. Well, in our times, historians have begun to say, hey, we're not all Christians, and it's really not fair to divide the world this way. So they now call it BCE, before the Common Era, and then at zero, the Common Era begins. And so a lot of times they'll even give this year's date, for example, as 1991 CE, 1991 in the Common Era. And out of respect to Jewish and other peoples who do not wish to divide the world with Christ's birth, I've adopted using before the Common Era as well. Although as a Christian, I still am kind of glad that the dividing point is considered to be Christ's birth. But there's no sense in shaming other people for the kind of historiography that we all do and share in common. So, anyhow, 1400 to 1200 BCE, we have a lot of international treaties from the Hittite Empire in Turkey. And the leader, or the conquering ruler in these treaties is called the suzerain. So these are called suzerainty treaties. And what they are is a way of structuring a relationship between the suzerain, the overlord, the conquering king, and the vassal, which is what the inferior king was called. He might still be a king, but the point was he was king of some local place and the suzerain had just conquered him and was now asking for some things from this other king and his people. Suzerain is really close etymologically to our word sovereign. And so it refers to this overlord or this king who's in charge. So, I, the conquering king, am talking to you. Let's say you're the leaders of this city-state here. And actually, it would be probably my general or my ambassador who was talking to you, not me really, some representative of mine. And telling you what I expect from you in this international treaty that we have here. I'm the one who conquered. I get to call the shots. I'm going to tell you what I expect from you. And in these treaties, there's a rather pre-prepared, planned-out way of how the treaty is going to go, what the parts are going to be. So now we'll look at the parts of one of these international treaties. That date 1200, that's about the same date as Moses, by the way. So we're talking about the same period of time. And although they were in Turkey, these Hittite kings had relationships with countries as far away as Egypt and Palestine and Mesopotamia, the Near East, where the Gulf War was just fought and beyond that. So, the parts of the treaty. These treaties began, first of all, with a preamble. The name of the king who had conquered. The formula for this was, these are the words of mighty king such and such, and then I would give my other titles. Second of all, our joint history would be named. It's kind of like, and because I conquered you in the battle of such and such a date, And from that time, took 12 prisoners of war, and but also gave you my protection through my armies. And, you know, so I would tell the history of the relationships between my people and your people. But because of all that, because of this joint history that I have just enumerated, therefore, this is what I want from you all. The stipulations of the covenant. This is what I want from you all. The obligations that I'm imposing on you. Now, this usually came boiled down to loyalty. Since I've conquered you, I expect you to be loyal. And sometimes it would be added to that, since I've conquered you, I expect you to provide soldiers for my army if I need to go fight somebody else. It could also include, since I've conquered you, I expect you not to murmur against me and my rule. You heard that word murmuring before? Anywhere? In the people of Israel in the wilderness, we're not supposed to murmur against God. Next, after telling you what I expected from you, maybe I would say, you know, I'm living in Turkey and I don't have any salt up there, but you're living in Palestine and you do, so one thing I expect is for you to bring salt to me or my representatives every year. That's part of the obligations I expect from you. Then, the next thing is witnesses to this treaty. And we're making this treaty in the face of, or in the presence of, and then I would list all of my gods and all of your gods, as well as any natural elements, mountains, sun, moon, stars, the ocean, or as well as any people or anything else who might hold this treaty up. Part of the idea is that, except for maybe some soldiers, I'm not going to be here, and how are you going to remember that you're loyal? Well, you're going to take this oath in a very solemn and serious and life-changing sort of way, so that you will remember the promises that you've made to me. And that's why we have to call the witnesses here, the gods, the earth, and sometimes people as well. Part of this is also curses and blessings. This is what these gods are going to do if you don't keep the treaty. If you do keep the treaty, the gods will bless you, the fields will be fertile, the sun will shine on you, the mountains will not fall on you. If you do not keep this treaty that we're making here and keep your loyalty to me and give what I'm asking you for that you're going to promise, then these curses will happen. Your fields will not be fertile, the mountains will fall on you, you'll suffer war and pestilence and locusts and all sorts of things like that. Therefore, now, are you ready to take the oath? In other
what
words,
choice do we have?
Yes, well, that's right. That's right. Are you going to sign the dotted line? And that's exactly true in these suzerainty treaties. I assume you could say no, and that would probably mean I'd come in with my armies, right? But you could say yes, and then you would be obliging yourself to face all these curses and blessings, but most of all to do what is required of you in the stipulations of this treaty. Besides the oath, there may be a solemn ceremony in order to make this even more impressive. And one solemn ceremony that often happened is that an animal or more, many animals, would be killed. Sometimes they would be cut in half, and the halves put here and there. And the people who were making this oath would walk between the parts of the animals, and that would mean, may I be cut in two, just as this animal has been cut in two, if I fail to keep the terms of this treaty. So this was very serious. And sometimes there were also, this is a long one, I'll write it and then I'll read it. Provisions for the deposit of the treaty and for its publicity. In other words, where are we going to keep this treaty that we've written down, and how often is it going to be read to you so that you can be reminded of this solemn commitment that you have entered into? And I might specify that I want this thing read at least once a year when the covenant will be renewed, or maybe twice, three, four times a year. And in the meantime, it's going to be kept in the library, or it's going to be kept in your king's, under your king's throne, or, you know, wherever it might be chosen to be kept. Well, this was a standard treaty form. It's almost like these conquering kings would call their attorneys, and the attorneys would take out the standard form and just fill in the names and the particular stipulations that needed to be made in a given case. And my theory, not just my theory, the theory I'm presenting to you from biblical scholars is that Israel knew about these treaties and, in fact, participated in some of them with other overlords. And the covenant between God and Israel is modeled in important ways after this standard international treaty form. There are also important and wonderful differences between this form and the covenant that Israel made with God, or God made with Israel. And it is important to say God made with Israel, because God is in the role of the suzerain, the overlord, who says, these are the terms of the covenant. Are you going to accept it or not? But in this case, a difference would be the people did not have to accept this covenant. Let's look at some of the analogies between this international covenant form and how it shows up in the Bible. The Sinai covenant is recorded in Exodus chapters 19 to 24. I hope you all have a Bible or can find one nearby.
Yes.
Okay. And we'll just go right on through. Will somebody please read Exodus 20, verse 2?
I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage.
Thanks. That one verse right there both has the name of the one who's making this treaty and the history between the treaty maker and the people with whom the treaty is being made. So, Exodus 20, verse 2a, and Exodus 20, verse 2b. This is a really brief little bit of history here. I'm the one who brought you out of slavery in Egypt. But if you want to think of it this way, the whole book of Exodus has just been spelling out the history in its long form. And these people have just arrived from out of the Exodus and are just getting started in the wilderness. And they don't really need to be reminded of what they've just been through. And so it's sufficient for God to say, I'm the God who brought you out of slavery in Egypt. And then the stipulations. We won't read those out loud because there are many verses, but glance through Exodus 20, verses 3 through 17. What is this section? The Ten Commandments. These are the stipulations of the covenant. This is what God expects. And there's something that you probably would expect based on international treaties here, and that is God expects loyalty from the people. The first table of the law, the first three commandments. But there's something that might also be unusual, and that is that God is not only asking for a relationship with the people, but is also stipulating that the people will have a certain kind of relationship with one another in commandments 4 through 10. Parents, children, families, honesty, the integrity of people's property and houses, all those things are to be protected in this covenant community, according to the stipulations of the suzerain, the sovereign, who is offering this treaty. The list of the witnesses to the treaty is not included in Exodus 20, but we'll see it where we go next in Joshua. Don't go there right now, though. Curses and blessings. There's an interesting chapter in Deuteronomy 28. Keep your finger in Exodus right here, but look at Deuteronomy 28 right now. You know, the Ten Commandments are recorded not just once in the Old Testament, but more than once. And the covenant is not made with people of Israel just once, but it's renewed and repeated at various times. And Deuteronomy is the story of one of those renewings of the covenant. And the Ten Commandments are given again, along with a lot of other laws Deuteronomy, Deutero means second, and nomos means law, so it's like the second version of the law, the second presentation of the law. And so in chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, which we think came from a later time in Israel's history, in fact, after they were living in the promised land, and it kind of let the old promises get dusty, needed to be reminded, then as through the mouth of Moses, these speeches were made, and the people were reminded of the covenant and invited to join again in that original covenant that had been made with their people generations before under Moses. So, looking through Deuteronomy 28, what kind of blessings do you see in the first part of the chapter? And just call out the ones that you really like.
Set Israel above the other nations.
Mm-hmm.
Many children, good crops.
Feed your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, the fruit of your womb, the blessed people.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be blessed when you come in and blessed when you go out.
Mm-hmm.
These holy people.
Mm-hmm.
Your enemies will be defeated.
Mm-hmm.
On the day-to-day things, if that's what it refers to, the basket and the kneading bowl, barns.
Mm-hmm. The previous Bible study, the staff Bible study just before this one, really liked verse 13. The Lord will make you the head and not the tail. You shall be only at the top and not at the bottom. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I'm commanding you today. Then starting in verse 15, check out some of the curses.
Whoa, wait a minute. Just went over this.
Some of them are the opposite of the blessings.
Disaster, confusion, trouble, and everything you do.
You can imagine that if you heard all of this read, and then I posed to you the question, so are you going to obey the commandments of the Lord your God starting this day? What would you answer?
Yeah.
So we have...
Is the curse the same as anathema, or is this a different
curse? Anathema is a Greek word, or Hebrew word, New Testament word for curse.
Yeah, is this the same?
Same type? Idea.
Right?
Yeah.
What, well, even includes the itch?
All right, then the oath. This is when that question is posed to you. Having heard what's expected of you, who is witnessing this, and what's going to happen if you don't obey and if you do obey, are you ready to sign your name to the dotted line? Look at Exodus 24, verse 3. Please read it out loud.
Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words that the Lord has spoken we will do.
And then words are not enough. We're going to make this really memorable, really impressive, really life-changing by the solemn ceremony connected with this, of which there are two parts. First, verses 4 through 8. Someone read that section, please. In chapter 24. 4 through 8.
And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord. And he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, "Behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words."
Preachers, take note. This is the text in a few weeks, the Old Testament lesson on the 10th Sunday after Pentecost in year B. This certainly would be impressive, right? You see the blood, you see the animals being killed, their blood drained, the blood poured on the altar, and then the blood sprinkled, poured on you. This would make an impact. What does it mean?
Well, it's sealed in blood.
Sealed in blood, yeah. Keep in your hand, your finger, your bookmark here in Exodus. Turn to Leviticus 17. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. That's how I memorized it in Sunday school. I made up this little sing-song rhyme. Leviticus 17, verse 11. For the meaning of the blood. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you for making atonement for your lives on the altar. For as life, it is the blood that makes the atonement. Life equals blood, or blood equals life. And so the meaning of this blood is that we now share a common life. It's shared between God, that's the blood on the altar, and it's shared between us. In a sense, this is a way of saying we're now blood relatives, even though we're not really blood relatives, even though we are not really related, or we're not formerly related to God. Now we are related to God, and now we are related to one another, because blood represents life. Now we have life in relationship to one another. Any more associations with that you can think of?
Christ, of course.
Mm-hmm. And from a New Testament perspective, mm-hmm. Yeah. And Passover lamb and the Lord's Supper, the blood of the new covenant, all of those are legitimate connections that are implied in this. Although today we're trying to look at it in its Old Testament context, first of all and primarily. Okay, the next thing, back to Exodus 24. The next thing that happens is a sacred meal. I'd like somebody to read verses 9 to 11 in chapter 24.
Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a
wonderful setting. And notice, God the sovereign, the suzerain, does not lay a hand on anyone, yet instead share a meal. So hospitality is extended between them. The ancient Near East, if you fed someone at your table, that meant you extended to them a bond of hospitality that you would not later break. But if you saw them again, you would befriend them again, and they would befriend you. It was a way of establishing peace, or shalom, of making a covenant, in a sense. And so the meal was the way of formalizing that. And the peace offering idea, those animals we had sacrificed earlier here, you notice it said that they were peace offerings, were part of that, was that that became a meal shared too. The animal that was killed, part of it was burnt up, and that was considered to be the part that went to the Lord. The rest of it was not burnt up, but barbecued. And part of the barbecue was given to the priests so that they had something to live on, since they couldn't be working out in the fields. They were busy with priestly duties all day. And the other portion would be shared by the offerers among their family and friends. And so it was a fellowship kind of meal. And New Testament ears, we obviously think of the Eucharist and how we join at the table of the Lord to share this peace offering, this meal of peace with one another. Then moving right along through this order of treaty that came from secular sources in the ancient Near East, I don't know if you can say it's secular sources. It was kind of from an alternative religion, because they certainly had their gods lined up in favor of this. But was used by Israel and God in a certain way to establish their relationship. There is a provision for putting the text of the covenant in a certain place and for making it public more than once a year. Look at Exodus 25, verse 21. Let me read that. Exodus 25, 21.
And you shall put the mercy seat on the top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I give you.
The Ark of a Covenant was a specially beautiful box in which the text of the treaty between God and Israel was going to be carried. And it was portable. It was carried around in the tent that they used for their church or their synagogue or their temple as they wandered through the wilderness. There was also provision for making this public more than once a year. That's, for example, in Exodus 34, verse 23.
In the Lord's meeting, they say covenant. Is there a particular reason how they came to do what we're saying now?
To say covenant?
Yeah, it says covenant instead of treaty.
Yeah, covenant is, in fact, the usual translation for the word in Hebrew. The Hebrew word that's usually used for this is, glad you pointed this out, berit. You heard of the Jewish Anti-Defamation League called B'nai Berith? B'nai means sons of, Berith, covenant, sons of the covenant. Berit is our Hebrew word for covenant. It's just usually translated covenant. I think I'm using treaty today just because of the analogy with the Hittite treaties. And just because covenant is one of those church words, and we're getting a little deeper slant on it, or we're seeing one certain facet of it by calling it a treaty. Or an alliance.
You could also call it a contract.
Contract, compact, agreement, testament. All of those words are appropriate. And maybe what's most distinctive about it is that in the ancient Near East, if we were related to each other, if we were part of the same family or clan or tribe, we would know what our responsibilities to one another were. But if we're not of the same tribe or family, then we don't have or we don't know what our responsibilities to one another are. What's happening in this covenant is that these separate tribes and families are having our familyhood extended, so that in fact what I owe my people in my own family, I also owe to you, even though you're from a different tribe or different family, as far as bloodlines go. Our king, our suzerain, is saying, all of you are adopted into this one family, and therefore you are all kin. You're not strangers to one another. You're family. And that'll be kind of the next line that we look down in the scriptures. Let's pause for a minute at this point, though, while I ask if looking at this treaty made between God and Israel in this way, as a treaty, brings up anything new to you that you hadn't thought of before or realized, or any questions that you want to ask. Yeah, Joanne.
Joan, I keep thinking, boy, what a threat. You know, in today's world, I think of that as a negative thing, you know. We don't want to be a threat to someone or something, but it was evidently with God, it was okay with his children, with the people.
With the blessings and the curses there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody want to comment on those? How do we deal with blessings and curses? How do we understand them?
Economic sanctions.
Economic sanctions. Yeah, these are God's economic sanctions.
That's what we do.
Yeah.
Nowadays when we're trying to get our...
That's right. We use the same strategy against other countries.
Cut off aid.
That's right.
Cause and result. Every act has its consequences.
And a lot of the curses actually would be the results of breaking the commandments. Nothing God has to invent and bring in from the outside. But one of the curses, for example, was you'll become engaged to a woman, but someone else will sleep with her first. That would be the result of living in a society where the sixth commandment was broken. So that's not saying anything new or adding anything. It's just saying if these stipulations are not kept, this is going to be the fabric of society. Another one said, you'll build a house, but somebody else will live in it. That would be the result of living in a society where the ninth commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, or thou shalt not steal, were not observed. And so really, a lot of the curses are explainable from that point of view. And, you know, if we are people who care for one another and who, as these commandments often make clear, have a particular regard for people who are poor or without other resources, have no one to take care of them, no blood kin to take care of them, or are even strangers in our midst, resident aliens, immigrant workers, like migrant farm workers or something like that, those are the ones we're supposed to look out for particularly because they don't have blood kin. And remember, we're trying to extend the range of people for whom we feel responsibility and with whom we live in community by this. Okay, let's take a quick tour through Joshua 24. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua. Joshua 24. Joshua 24, the beginning of verse 2. Now here's the setting for this. Joshua was the leader who followed Moses. This is sometime later than the covenant given at Sinai. In fact, this is at the Promised Land. And they're in Shechem. Shechem is a city, a very impressive city, I understand from the description. It's a walled city that's in a very narrow mountain pass. So it's a position that's a strong position. They can keep away enemies who come up from either side. It's between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And here's this city. That's where Joshua has gathered with the people. And ahead of them lies this broad, fertile plain, a beautiful sight looking out over the valley. And so Joshua said to the people, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel." There's the preamble in the first part of verse 2, Joshua 24, verse 2. Now, the historical prologue, or the joint history of the parties, is in the end of verse 2 through verse 13. Look through that. It's a lot longer than what we saw at Sinai. And why do you think it's longer?
History's a little bit more.
There's more history by this time. That's right. And there's another reason as well. These are not the people who've just come through the Exodus and know all about that. In fact, it was Joshua at Shechem who made with the people, or had the people make the covenant that brought the 12 tribes together. Not all of these people gathered here had been through the Exodus. Some of them were picked up along the way. And so the God of the Exodus was not something that an experience that they identified with. So here the covenant needs to be renewed because new people have been brought in and they need to be incorporated and understand the basis on which they become part of the people, and the people have to understand the basis on which they're being accepted into the people of God. The stipulations, Joshua 24, verse 14. This, in contrast, is really brief stipulations. It's basically for loyalty. We assume Joshua also could have taken the text of the covenant from the Ark of the Covenant and read that to the people as well. One thing that we do have in Joshua here is the list of the witnesses to the treaty. Look at Joshua 24, verse 22. Joshua said to the people, "You are witnesses against yourselves that you've chosen the Lord to serve him." And they said, "We are witnesses." But also look at verse 27. Joshua said to the people, "See, this stone shall be a witness against us." They set up a stone, that's in verse 26, a large stone, and set it up there under the oak in the sanctuary of the Lord. "This stone will be a witness, for it has heard all the words of the Lord that he spoke to us. Therefore, it shall be a witness against us if you deal falsely with your God." And then the people do make their promise, Joshua 24, verse 24. The people said to Joshua, "The Lord our God we will serve, and him we will obey." And so they did it, they wrote it down, and then the covenant ceremony there is setting up that stone. And this wasn't the only time the covenant was renewed. In fact, as I said, in Deuteronomy, it was time to renew it again. You remember the story of Deuteronomy? King Josiah, who was king in Jerusalem, and the country was, by then, well, boy, this goes into a lot of Old Testament history I'm not sure I want to get into, but let's just say that King Josiah in Jerusalem came to the throne when he was 8, and about the time that he was 18, they were rebuilding the temple, which had kind of fallen into disrepair. And they found something in the temple. It was a book of the law. And so people who found it went rushing to Josiah and said, "Listen to this, listen to what we found." And they consulted a prophetess whose name was Huldah. And she said, "Well, this is what it means." And Josiah, hearing this book of the law, including its blessings and curses, said, "Oh no, we haven't been doing this. No wonder we're in disarray and disrepair in our society now. And no wonder our enemies are attacking us. So we're going to have a reform, and we're going to start living by this covenant again." And Deuteronomy, finding the book of Deuteronomy in the temple, became the basis for covenant renewal. So it was an ongoing process. Every generation and every new group of people had to be incorporated into the covenant. How do we do that in church? Incorporate people into God's covenant. What covenant ceremonies do we have?
Baptism.
Yeah. And? And the communion meal. And confirmation. Affirmation of baptism. Right? You know, ideally people ought to affirm their baptism every few years, not just at puberty, but again and again and again. There ought to be a lot of opportunities for affirmation of baptism. Every major stage and age of life could well renew baptism. Okay, we've kind of looked at the kingship angle. Now let's tack down that kinship angle. So I want you to go back to Leviticus. Leviticus 25.
Sing to us again.
Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. Leviticus 25, take a look at verse 25. "If any one of your kin falls into difficulty and sells a piece of property, then the next of kin shall come and redeem what the relative has sold." This is kinship obligations. If we're related by blood and you lose your property and I'm your next of kin and I can afford it, I'm going to help you get your property back because that's your means of making a living and feeding your family. Feeding your part of our family, actually. Take a look at verse 35. "If any of your kin fall into difficulty and become dependent on you, you shall support them. They shall live with you as though resident aliens." Take a look at verse 39. "If this happens and they become dependent on you, you shouldn't make them serve as slaves." Verse 47, "If they become dependent on someone else, a resident alien in the community, buy them back as soon as possible. And if you can't do that, then your uncle or your brother or someone else in the family ought to buy them back so that they can be free people again, working their own land as part of the family." This next of kin who had the responsibility of buying back was called the Redeemer. And you may remember from another part of the Old Testament that part of the deal there was, too, that if a man died without leaving any children as his heirs, his brother was to marry his widow. And if they had a son, the first son would be designated as the legal heir of the dead man so that his name and his inheritance could continue. And then the subsequent sons would be the sons of the brother. And that's how Ruth ended up marrying Boaz. Her husband had died. She had no children. When she moved back to Israel then, Naomi, her mother-in-law, had her look up Boaz, who was next of kin, and make a proposition to Boaz, hey, you know, my husband died, we had no heirs, aren't you going to exercise your obligation as next of kin? Well, Boaz said, uh-oh, there's one other person in line who'd be next of kin before I would. I'd love to do it, but we'll have to check with him. They did check with this other next of kin, and he said no, he wasn't interested. And so Boaz was able to marry Ruth. And so Boaz was her redeemer, in the sense. Now, that's kinship. And what God has done in the covenant at Sinai is said, my people have been sold into slavery. They've gone into debt in Egypt. And I'm going to buy them back and bring them to this land. I'm going to act like the next of kin to my people Israel who are in slavery in Egypt and bring them out. And at Sinai, God is declaring to the people who've just come out of slavery that that's what God has done. God has redeemed them, bought them back when they got into difficulty with another power. And therefore now we share the same life. We're part of the same family. But it's not a closed group. It's a family. You're all adopted, in a sense. And so our kinship goes in expanding and expanding circles to include more and more people, all these 12 tribes. And through you, the nations of the world shall be blessed. So kingship, we're kind of back with the thesis I started with, kingship and kinship illuminate each other. And we have a God who acts like a relative and a relative who acts like a king in order to both support us and expand our community. So we can't just close in because God is king and intends this treaty to grow. But as we grow, we can't forget the intimacy and the community and the responsibility that we have because we share the one life. So sometimes when in the prayers, the Lord's Prayer or in the liturgy, when we come to the kingdom of God, I think to myself or say to myself or say out loud if I'm leading liturgy, kingdom of God. Kind of an inclusive language version of the kingdom of God.
That's one thing I've always felt in all of these covenant repetitions, all of the curses are there and they're pretty awful. It's always seemed to me that the major emphasis has been the blessing and the concept that you are my people, you are my chosen people. And the curses are almost like cause and effect. This is what will happen if you don't do it. But it seems to me Israel didn't even historically look at the curses as what motivate them as much as when they were reminded, hey, God loved us, he took us out of Egypt.
And society works well when we live this way.
And children learn better with compliments than they do with threats. Mm-hmm. And I think God knows that.
Mm-hmm. Some more comments. I want you to be sure to notice in this covenant that there are two parties to the covenant, even though they're not equal parties. God has the initiative and says, this is what the covenant is going to be. But the response of the people is critical, or the covenant is not established and doesn't stand. God offers it in gracious love. The people accept it and live by it and follow it in gracious response. Some of the other covenants we'll look at, God is the only party, and God says, I'm going to do this, and God does it, and human response doesn't matter. But this is one with two parties, even though the parties are not equal in power or equal in authority.